And I haven't got a title, so I haven't got a talk, but it might come at the end, the title. Some of you know who have some background of connection with Dharma teachings and practices. The rather extraordinary and unusual interfacing that's taking place in Buddhist world and the Jewish Hebrew tradition, and it's no more, it's very clearly evident, particularly in the insight meditation world, and it has been taking place for the past generation or so, around the last 30 years or so. And one of the ways that that has been manifesting is the number of Dharma teachers who have been brought up in the Jewish families. Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and Norman Feldman and Stephen Levine and so on and so on and so on. And on the face of it, it would appear that there's quite a and the insight meditation world, more so than any of the other Buddhist traditions. And I think on the face of it, part of it is due to the number of those people who I just mentioned and others traveling to India during the 60s, the 70s, the 80s and 90s. And it's almost as though something deep in within, as with other people from other backgrounds and traditions, being touched in such a way that it brought something spiritual, which is hard to define, out of the human being more deeply. And for others, and I've certainly noticed this in 20, 25 years or more of teaching, that whether it's here in Israel through Stephen's kind invitation to me in the early 1990s, whether it's in India or in the United States, that it happens regularly, that is very often, in which perhaps through some reflection or some depth of insight, or in some way or other, being touched in such a way that for a number of people it touches religious roots and is a kind of re-looking and re-examining of one's own religious roots and traditions for some people. And therefore, Dharma teachings and practices, for some, become a way of giving support to one's own religious traditions and practices. And there is quite a interfacing taking place. Sometimes in India, elsewhere, as an example, and other teachers, giving teachings to Christian monks and nuns. And it's not to change them from one religion to another, but help them to understand, hopefully, their tradition more. And I think especially the teachings of the rabbi from Nazareth. And others touch other deeper roots within themselves. And if I may say, as a Gentile, is that would be an appropriate word to use for me? If I may say, as a Gentile, I probably made bigger contribution of any Gentile that I know to encouraging people with the Jewish roots to reconnecting with their own tradition. Is there a word for such a person like me? There should be, I think. No, that's not. And what I think is important in all of this, as has been said several times over the days in various ways, that in the deep listening inwardly to ourselves, that kind of deep listening sometimes touches something which some will call spiritual, and sometimes it's spiritual and religious. Spiritual meaning in terms of awarenesses, sensitivities, heartfulness, expansiveness of insights and discovery, and the application of that in a respectful way into this world, in very deep and profound ways. And sometimes, for some, and maybe for some of you here, and it's not necessary, but for some of you here, it also meets with something religious. And sometimes that religious is in the Buddhist tradition. And some people do love the features of the Buddhist tradition. And others, that meeting in a religious way touches upon within one's own Jewish tradition, and being respectful and acknowledging that. In that exploration which takes place, I feel that it's almost too old a thing to say in such company as here, it's almost as though, dare I say, oh say it, Christopher, and shut up, a fresh kind of covenant is required, which acknowledges and recognizes the value of the wisdom of the past, and I think it needs a genuine deep extension into the realities of the present. It needs ways to extend itself into the present in meaningful and insightful ways. And if one takes an environment like, you know, one that we have here, of a community of us here together, and in the community of us being together, there's a tremendous amount of skill in this room, and just the number of you who are connected with helping professions, the number of you who are connecting with environmental concerns and issues, the number of you who are involved in the arts and creativity and communicating to large public audiences, the number of you who are involved in contemporary technology, computer skills, and generating information that way, the number of you in the healing field, etc., etc. And it seems to me that the kind of human resources which are available in such communities needs to forge a kind of new understanding, as I say, always not denying the old, but a fresh kind of covenant with existence, which somehow acknowledges the severe issues of what it is to be living in our time. And therefore, the resources of the old, of what's insightful and invaluable in it, and what applies and what needs to be drawn out in the present. And I think people of religious disposition, people of a secular disposition, people of a spiritual disposition, we need to develop and cultivate that. Sometimes, in looking at this, and I'll explore in the practical ways through the meditations in a moment or two, that kind of bond and connecting of deep concern for the quality of our inner life and how that manifests in the world that we live in, means that somehow, I think, with all of us, you and I need to keep remembering in our life that much of the condition of this world has its background and its roots in our inner life. It comes out of the events of heart and mind. And not all, but much of the issues of anguish and suffering and difficulty is the result of the condition of the mind. Of course, there are natural disasters, but even some of those has its relationship to the state of mind. So if you and I give great care and attention to our inner life, and we bring equal care and attention to the outer life, in a way, that is what makes our life noble. And if we feel that those kind of inner changes, we feel it in potential but not actual, I do think we have to consider and reconsider, as everybody has done here, of regularly, and I mean regularly, putting ourselves in fresh environments which do affect the consciousness. And you have a whole tradition of this in this country. Men and women who are willing, and are willing, as you have done here, to put oneself in a fresh environment, away from the known and the familiar, in order to see the impact it can have on conscious, to make us more conscious. In after the end of the next 5-day retreat, because it's been recommended, Stephen especially been encouraging me every year, Christopher, haven't yet been to the Sinai. So every year, the year has come. And so after finishing on the 5-day retreat, we'll go to the Sinai, and various friends in England, the Israeli friends, have been saying, Christopher, you must go here, you must go there. And everybody has their favourite Bedouin tent to stay in, and etc. There, but naturally enough, my interest in that is to see what is believed or said to be is Mount Sinai. Clearly. And in that, I'll hope, I don't know if I'll find a burning bush there, but and incidentally, one could contemplate the profound significance on why God appeared in the burning bush. You could spend a useful 365 days just contemplating that. Very beautiful thing. So sometimes, as I say, we need to find ways and means in our life to step out of what we know, because the consciousness, and most of us, I include myself in my monk's life, etc., seem to have opened up areas of our life which weren't being opened up when I was a newspaper reporter in London, which was what I was doing, when I was supposed to be fairly well informed in doing political, social, crime reporting, etc., etc. And it took steps out of the familiar to shift consciousness in a way which I couldn't have imagined. And although everybody keeps reminding me, oh, Israel is such a small country, it's not that small. There's plenty of open spaces. I've been to Western Galilee, where Stephen lives, and have been on the road. You know, and people say, "Oh, Jerusalem's a suburb of Tel Aviv, etc., etc." You know, or you know, Israel is just no different from LA, or actually, there's a lot of mythology going on around around here. It's a kind of mutual conspiracy to want to feel small, etc. And in just stepping out into wider open spaces, into coming into in environments, and people have said to us regularly, I can't come here, not in July. It's too hot. Well, so far we've all survived. None of us are on a drip feed through exhaustion or anything. So say sometimes in looking, if we are to open the consciousness out and to keep it steady and open, it does and it will require from us fresh initiatives, new steps, exploring new things, going into areas and ways and means which are unfamiliar or difficult, and that trusting that somehow in the process of all of that, something is trust worthwhile can emerge out of it. It can emerge out of it. And there are many ways for that. The very openness, I'm sure some of your what shall we say, brothers and sisters, actual or metaphorical, in this country, may feel some concern or disapproval of the number of people who go to India or number of people in this country who are participating in retreats, and then to go and listen to a Gentile as well, etc., does, I'm sure, raise eyebrows. Even if I am a circumcised Gentile, it's still still a Gentile. I said to my mother one time, slight story, how come I ended up circumcised? I was curious. She said, well, your dad didn't decide and I didn't decide. Well, who decided? Well, I didn't decide. I was like this. And she said, what happened was, for those of you who might be interested, I mean, may not be interested in my anatomy, I am. She said, what happened was that when I was very small, in the urine tract, it was some blockage, a little bit of pain. So I had to go and have a quick operation to urine tract and clear it, and it was all right because obviously I was very small, I was very, very young, experiencing some discomfort there. And she said, so when you came out of the operating theatre, you're in this little cot, and the surgeon had decided just to cut it off. So sometimes people, and I've had various conversations with us, sometimes in many things, sometimes rational things of life are there, and then sometimes things hard to comprehend what the purpose may be. But in such an example as that, my general view that I take with this is, I don't think it's that dramatic. Some may have a different view, but I don't think in this case, Brit Menach, have I got it right? After 8 days? So I don't, somehow some people think it's an incredibly strange thing to do, but for myself, and in talking with other friends, I think sometimes there's just tradition and the father and the son, etc. But I do think it's in every area of life, things are worth exploring and looking into, and just sometimes just raising questions about, not with approval and disapproval, right and wrong, and using heavy duty language. I don't think it's necessary at all in this particular example that I gave, but much more that people are free to talk, free to explore these things. Because sometimes, for some people, it can seem as a terrible pressure. And then it creates difficulties between friends or families or whatever. So Dharma teachings and practices, spiritual, religious, new forms of language and exploration, I think are vital, and therefore we use communication to look into everything. We use the skills as men and women on this earth to attend to issues which need attending to. And for some, and that will be for some of you here as well as elsewhere, obviously, that what sometimes that need is that we have to get beyond the place of fear. If there's going to be a real renewal as men and women on this earth who care for this existence, it's vital in that we go beyond the place of fear. Fear meaning, as was being said in the group today, that kind of force inside of us at times which just holds us back from saying things which we need to say. And it isn't easy to do that. And sometimes it makes people upset because of what one says. And to give you a very small personal example of what I mean, when the Buddhist teachers had their conference in San Francisco last month, I referred to it earlier in the retreat, the Buddhist world finds it extremely difficult to enter into the language of criticism. It feels extremely uncomfortable with things which sound like or imply us and them. And that was extremely apparent during this Buddhist conference. People terribly nice to each other, publicly. So I had 5 minutes to say something. And if I can remember, and I called it, if I remember, the four M's. One of them wasn't meditation, I think. First one I said was, can't the Buddhist world in the West drop the language, some of you will know this, called Mahayana and Hinayana, big vehicle and small vehicle, because this language of Mahayana Hinayana has caused in the last 2,000 years so much conflict and superiority and inferiority. Why do we have to import Mahayana Hinayana language? Let's leave it in the East. I said, leave it in the dustbin of history, forget it, etc. And some went, oh. Just feel the tension go up in the room. The second is that in Buddhagaya, there is a wish, this out of a Tibetan Buddhist, to build a huge statue to Maitreya Buddha. The height of this statue is 150 meters. The world's biggest statue, at a cost of $150 million. In the poorest region of South Asia. If this Buddhist organization was willing to take off 1 meter of this statue and save $1 million, it would educate 100 and the children in 180 villages from the age of 5 to 15, which surround the land for that statue. There are some who are completely identified with building this statue. Most of the money coming from Taiwan. When we were there, I mentioned there that M was the military. The Dalai Lama, who's much loved, came for a couple of days, and the security people from the State Department turned up. Metal detectors, body search, several posted around the meditation hall, presumably concerned that some wacko might not want to shoot the Dalai Lama or whatever. And then the State Department said to us, all the teachers have to be out of our room at 6:30 in the morning so they can do a search of the room. So perhaps it's just Christopher. So I said in the hall, well, I'm saying it more gently than what I actually said it. Most of the teachers probably do something before breakfast besides sleep, and teachers are doing their mantras and they're doing their visualizations and they're doing their vipassana practice and they're doing their yoga and they're doing their pujas, etc., etc., and we're on sacred land, right? So I was doing my sitting, 6 to 7, so I just said, well, I'm going to do my sitting. So all the others got moved off, and the official from the State Department was very angry with me. I could have you arrested, put the handcuffs on you, and have you down in the county jail in minutes for disobeying the State Department. I said, sir, Christopher sitting cross-legged on his bed with his hands in his lap, I promise you, is no threat to the Dalai Lama. Really. But the tension is so strong. So I said, you're so tense. And then he said, please meditate for me. I can't remember what the other M was, but it becomes a matter. So sometimes, that's what I say here. One person said during the conference, sometimes when we speak up there, we don't say it clearly, we don't say it nicely, we don't say it skillfully, etc. And then afterwards we feel, oh, we overdid it, or it was too rushed, or we sounded too judgmental, or whatever. And so one of the women teachers said, and so she said, so sometimes we say something, it's gone out there, and then, to use the English metaphor, we feel afterwards we've got egg on our face. Understand the metaphor? Yeah. End up with egg on our face. So I said, from experience, perhaps too often, sometimes one speaks up and speaks out. And I said, I know for myself, I'd rather take the chance and speak up rather than the fear hold back. Speak up and speak out. And sometimes I speak up and I speak out and I've got a 3-egg omelette on my face. And so I say, what I mean is that sometimes we have to take some risks. To, using the Buddha's criteria here, sometimes to speak up, to try to speak what is true and useful. speak what is true and useful. And I believe from listening, and listening here as well as elsewhere, that there is a lot of deep truth with people. There's a lot of deep awarenesses with people there. And it only takes a little fear in any situation to stop us speaking up. Only takes the wish to be approved. When we know something isn't right, we know something needs to be said, we know something needs to show more openness of heart, or a little bit more clarity, or a little bit more vision, or whatever. And it's up to people like ourselves, trying to find ways to live with as much awareness as possible, to be able to speak, to find our voice. If we can't do it, who the heck can do it? If we can't find the energy for it, who are we going to rely on? The politicians? Phew. So the steps that you and I make in our own ways in life, make steps for other people. And such extraordinary thing is that sometimes in aloneness, in meditation, in time in the desert, in places of quietitude, the voice can be found. And this earth genuinely depends on our voice. Nobody else's. It's our voice that will make the difference. Why? Because we care. Why? Because we're concerned with ethics. Why? Because we want to live with awareness. Why? Because we want to understand what is beneficial from the past and what is helpful and insightful, and and we've got the entire resources of the past to draw upon. Sometimes in the process of the meditation, and we touched on this in the inquiry this afternoon, there is some of the initial intentions that we bring to the situation. And sometimes those initial intentions, and this was touched on in the small group, one of the small groups today, are such that we see the process very usefully in very down-to-earth practical terms. How can I learn to be with myself more clearly? How can I learn with my eyes to see more clearly, ears to hear more clearly, smell, taste, touch? How can I learn to find what it is to be more clear in my daily life, in my daily experience? Clear about my heart, clear about my intentions, clear about the priorities, clear about what I need to look at, clear about what I need to cultivate and develop. And hopefully all of that is becoming more clear to us. And the more of the practices that we do, in the broad sense of practices, more interest there is to live a truly clear life. That has a very pragmatic and very important aspect to it. If we are clear, we are less demanding on life. If we are content, we are less wanting from others. If we feel nourishment within ourselves, we'll be looking for less in terms of pressure on others. If there is greater, as one person was saying today, if there's greater appreciation for the ordinary and the everyday, our obsession with privilege, status, power, money, possessions goes down correspondingly. The more appreciation that you and I have for what we cannot have, the more feeling of interconnection with what we cannot have, the less the mind is wanting to have. The material world is a compensation for an emptiness, an unpleasant emptiness in our inside of ourselves. So appreciation, which is a core teaching, is vital for us. It's vital for the very life of our planet, that you and I touch on places of what we appreciate, which we cannot own, cannot possess, and cannot get. And if we can let our heart feel that in our day-to-day life more and more, everything else begins to fall into place, just through the bringing out of appreciation. I think one of the most touching stories of that one sometimes is the bravery of people, and sometimes it's the quiet courage of people. The quiet courage, the two examples that I've got, one of them you may know far better than I. One example: a friend who is a doctor working in a hospital in New York, young doctor, newly qualified, was being taken on a tour of the hospital wards, and when he reached one end of the hospital, he was introduced to a woman who was in an iron lung. You know what an iron lung is? Yeah. Like a huge big metal tube. You can't be out of it for more than 3 or 4 minutes because the lungs will collapse. So the life is spent in this iron lung. This is about 20 years ago. And when he looked at her card at the foot of the bed, and it gave her name, her age, the health checks, the temperature, etc., her address of family, etc., and the year of admission was 30 years before. And he said to her, just a young doctor in his mid-late 20s, and he said to her, "How do you stand it? Every day, same posture, just there." And she said that sometimes, on a nice day, the nurses will open the window and the breeze will brush across her cheek. And she says, that makes it all worthwhile. That is sensitivity. That is receptivity. That is what is meant by something that one cannot own. And he told me, the doctor was on a retreat with me, said he used to go to see her regularly, and she was consistently content and happy. And that was her gift from life to her. And the other, during this dreadful, obscene fascist period in the 1940s, when many of your elders were forced to wear the Star of David, this is in Holland, there were hundreds and hundreds of Dutch men and women who put the Star of David and sewed it on their clothes to confuse the German army, the Gestapo, the fascists. And amongst the millions of brave gestures, But men and women were willing to do that. And so sometimes, in various ways in life, the sense of appreciation is one of the deepest heartfelt of all feelings. And I think that needs to be brought out of ourselves. No matter what the difficulties that go on with life, that if that's, if we could be touched in that way, I think it has the power to shake up our whole vision of what matters. And sometimes it seems to be occurring quite naturally for some people over the days of the retreat. And came on the first evening here, and after all, it's only four nights ago. And the first day is complete absence of any appreciation. It's like a marine survival course. And the timetable hasn't changed that much over the days. And Stephen and Catherine and I were commenting today. How, just in the space of some days together, the energy, the interest, the inquiry, the exploration, the small groups, the one-to-one, and the atmosphere genuinely touching deep places of interest, deep places of concern, and deep places of recognition of what is lovely. So even in just, not for everybody, but even in the space of just the silence and the meditation and the willingness to stay through a process, through the whole of the day, out of it, naturally something begins to happen. That is a force for enlightening our life. That we need established in our culture. Then all other things will begin to fall into place. May all beings live with deep happiness. May all beings live with wisdom. May all beings live a free and enlightened life. Have our 2 or 3 minutes of shared silence, please.